thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing news source.
Well, with Fed policymakers expected to begin a new rate cut cycle in less than 2 hours, it's a real pleasure to welcome back to GoldSeek Radio the former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy in the Reagan administration and editor and columnist for Wall Street Journal Business Week. Welcome back, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts.
Well, thank you.
You know, the Fed head Jerome Powell will cut rates, Fed funds futures showing about 80% probability. We'll see a quarter rate point cut to around 2%. And this is on the heels of last week's weaker than expected GDP figure. Just how far do you think they'll go, and what does that mean for investors?
If you look at total creditor claims against the outstanding debt, here we're talking about not just personal debt, student loans, auto loans, mortgage loans, but the claim, you know, the holdings of government bonds, say U.S. Treasuries. These claims are really larger than the economy can pay. And so what we could be headed into is a regime of negative interest rates. Because what negative interest rates do is they reduce the outstanding. And it won't really matter from the standpoint of it shrinking savings to a level that they might be able to pay. Now, I don't think they can make them negative enough to shrink the debt down. And it seems to me sooner or later there's going to have to be some form of debt forgiveness. Debt's going to have to be written down. So when you ask what does it mean that they're cutting the rates. Once again, since they don't tell us the truth about inflation, we don't really know what the real rates are because we don't really know what the real inflation rate is because they changed the way they measured it in order to minimize inflation. So these kinds of questions are hard to answer, and the economics profession doesn't pay much attention. So what we do know, I think, is that lowering the interest rates is not going to make investment in plant and equipment any more attractive. We already know it's not attractive because what have the firms done with their profits but to buy back their own shares? Not only that, many of the firms have gone into debt, borrowing money in order to decapitalize themselves by buying back the shares. So we know for years now, industry hasn't seen any reason to invest. Instead, the companies are decapitalizing themselves. They're buying back their shares because it's the best use of their profits, or so they think. So if you're sitting on a bunch of profits and you don't see anything to do with them except buy back your shares, how come they cut the interest rates a quarter of a point or half a point or a point? Are you going to see investment all of a sudden more profitable? That's not going to happen.
You know, Dr. Roberts, this is an interesting point you bring up with the share buybacks. Clearly, with debt low and expected to drop now, rates expected to drop on the issuance of corporate debt especially, this presents a conundrum because our CEOs are essentially unpaid for the most part. They're counting on those stock options of their companies to be their big payoff, many of them, not all. And, of course, the share buybacks gives an artificial inflation that I think you've alluded to correctly on the price there. And so do you think that it might be wise as soon as possible for for our elected officials and other policymakers to curtail their compensation should be tied to another metric other than their share price appreciation. Maybe the better way would be to keep buybacks to a minimum.
Some years ago, Congress got it in their head that CEOs should not be paid more than $1 million a year in salary, unless it was performance related. And so what that meant then was that the main reward package to the executives, and of course to directors, came from rising share price. So that's why they do the buybacks. They do the buybacks. That was an unintended consequence of Congress legislating $1 million salary as the limit that could be written off as a business expense. So if they were paid a salary of $2 million, the second million would not be written off as an expense. And so they said, okay, but if the company has really good performance, then, and bonuses are reflecting that, then they can have those bonuses as pay, and they can be deducted as a business cost. So that's how it all started. The buybacks were a creation of Congress passing the other law, trying to limit compensation. I think it's probably a bit late in the game for them to come in and change it, because the problem really is that the American corporations don't see investment opportunities for their profits. They don't see investment opportunities for their borrowings, except to buy back their own shares. So we were looking at that as a way to understand whether or not a lower interest rate was likely to stimulate any new investment. And I think it's difficult to think that the lower interest rate can stimulate investment when the corporations don't see any place to invest other than buying back their shares. In fact, the lower interest rate will make it a little bit cheaper for them to borrow money to buy back their shares. What the lower interest rate does, the way they will achieve the lower interest rate is by being there to buy bonds. You know, the Fed will buy more bonds. That's how they get the interest rate down. And the money going into the financial system will continue to prop up the stock market, even though profitability of the companies is falling. But where is the money going to go? What these low interest rates sort of signal is more rounds of QE, of quantitative easing. So that money will keep the bubble whole. It'll keep the bubble from popping. So what you could say, and of course I don't know that this is a fact and can't prove it, but you could say that what the Fed is doing, having got the whole system in a bubble, it's decided it's got to keep it going. And so it's going to feed more money. And the money will keep the stock market up, even as there's nowhere to invest. And so share prices will get further removed from the profitability of the company. The P/E ratios will get more absurd. And so I think that's, in other words, the problems are not being dealt with. It's hard to see what the lower interest rate can do other than to put more liquidity from the Fed into financial assets.
Now, it's well said. Clearly, the Fed balance sheet is still hovering in the $3 trillion area. anything over, I think, $500 billion was unprecedented just a decade ago before the Great Recession. And so one would have thought they had, with such a robust economy, an opportunity to clear that balance sheet considerably more than they have. So it almost appears as though we're entering, you know, the unsavory prospect of runaway money printing or possibly even inflation, which I think you addressed earlier. When does the music stop? Do you have a metric that you're monitoring, or do you think they're going to keep the shell game going longer than most people expect?
Yes, and I think they're going to keep the shell game going, and they can keep it going, as far as I can tell, until there is abandonment of the dollar. If de-dollarization spreads, and of course the sanctions that Washington keeps putting on other economies helps de-dollarization spread, so that the sanctions in effect are undermining the dollar as world reserve currency. As people abandon it in order not to be vulnerable to sanctions. And here we're talking about a large part of the world, Russia, China, India, Iran, Venezuela. As they abandon the dollar, then it's hard for the Fed and the Bank of Japan and the Bank of England and the European Central Bank to keep the dollar propped up by all of those countries also creating money. So de-dollarization results in a reduced demand for dollars, and yet the supply is massive, and so the dollar could fall in value. The Fed, you see, can print all the money it needs to buy stocks and bonds, but it can't print foreign currencies with which to buy the dollar. So I think until the dollar starts being moved aside as the main world reserve currency, the Fed can keep the financial assets high. They buy bonds, therefore it drives up the price. If the stock market tries to adjust, all the Fed has to do is purchase S&P futures, and it stops the fall. You know, people are not paying attention. The central banks now intervene in all kinds of things. For example, the Japanese central bank actually owns somewhere between a fifth and a fourth of all Japanese equities. The central bank actually buys the shares. What I think happens in the United States is the Fed doesn't buy the shares, but if the market starts to come down in a way that they're worried about, they step in and buy S&P futures. And that stops the decline. So when you have this level of manipulation, you really can't know what to expect. You know, say, you know, all of this started in the last year of the Reagan administration with what they call the Plunge Protection Team. The George Herbert Walker Bush people were afraid that the economy, that the stock market would collapse. You know, they had that scare in 87, and that this would block George Herbert Walker Bush from getting the Republican nomination and being elected. So they created this, what they call the Plunge Protection Team, which was to ensure that George Herbert Walker Bush was Reagan's successor. Well, I don't think anybody understood at the time the consequences of that. But the Fed now has a massive trading desk, as far as I can retail, it can essentially intervene in any market. Commodities, gold, currencies, whatever. None of this gets any explanation or coverage. The Economist are quiet. The financial press is quiet. And so people really haven't much clue about what's really going on. And the explanations we're given, for example, for quantitative easing, which was, it'll spur investment and everybody will do better. That's not the reason they did it. They did it to bail out the big banks. And the process of bailing out the big banks, all the money, as you pointed out, the Fed's balance sheet went from $800 billion to $4.5 trillion. I don't know where it is now, whether they succeeded in reducing it very much. I doubt it. But all that money went into financial assets. And so you've had this great stock market boom for a decade that's not based in any reality. It's based in liquidity that the Fed pumped into the markets. And we know it's not based in any reality, Chris, because there hasn't been any growth in real family median income for a long time. We know that a huge percentage of young people are so burdened by student loans and poor job opportunities that they cannot form households. They live at home with their parents. There are practically as many people, 24 to 34 years old, living at home with the parents as are living independently. And that's because the huge debts, the student loan debts, the poor jobs, the low pay, they can't afford to live independently. So how are they buying and causing retail sales to support profits of companies? And clearly they aren't, because the companies don't see any reason to invest in expanding their output. And that's why they buy back the shares. I think I read not long ago that something like 100% of the profits of companies are used to buy back the shares. So if there are no investment opportunities because there's nothing to drive consumer demand, aggregate demand, what's to drive it? Not growth in real wages. Not business investment, because business investment is buying up, is decapitalizing the companies by buying the shares. If they borrow money, it's not for new plant and equipment, it's to buy back shares. So when you look at this picture, you know, it doesn't really make any sense. And so we come back to this notion that we have a booming economy. Do we? Or is that a statistical creation? If you undermeasure inflation, then the nominal GDP that you deflate is not fully deflated. And so the growth that you think you're seeing is really just a growth in prices, not real output. So there's so much rigmarole and rigging, and the way they measure inflation is different than it used to be. It's measured in a way to understate it. Well, if you understate inflation, you overstate GDP growth. So it could well be there hasn't been any booming economy. That it could well be, and some people say it's the case, that there's been no growth in real output for a decade.
Our good friend John Williams at ShadowStats.com, you may be familiar with his alternative economic think tank research. He's crunched the numbers for decades for corporate America. If you look very carefully at his GDP numbers, when they're adjusted for his corrected inflation figures based on the 1980s number, he finds exactly what you just said. We've had flat to negative real GDP output. Appreciate your thoughts today on just how our officials might try to rectify the situation. Well, I shouldn't say rectify. I mean, according to you and many of our top guests here, Dr. Kotlikoff of Boston University agrees with you. They'll always try to keep the Titanic from taking on too much water and capsizing too quickly. Will we wake up and find that the dollar has a different name or moniker attached to it? Bank accounts still reflect the same amount of dollars, but have 50% less purchasing power.
Well, this would be the implication of the dollar losing its world reserve currency role. You see, if you're the world reserve currency, which is the reason that we wanted to take it away from the British so much after World War II, if you're the world reserve currency, you can pay your bills by printing money. Because every other country is willing to hold your currency because it's the world reserves. And all transactions are settled in it. And so it guarantees a demand for your money. And so that removes constraints on your ability to create it. And this is particularly the case when the United States has such financial predominance that it can achieve the cooperation of other central banks from Tokyo to the European Central Bank in maintaining the exchange rate stability of the dollar. Now, it fluctuates a little bit, but they keep it pretty much. So that the printing of American dollars it does not result in the dollar losing its exchange value vis-a-vis the euro or the British pound or the Japanese yen, because if we print, they print. When we had quantitative easing, they had quantitative easing. In fact, I think the European Central Bank is now into negative interest rates. So until the dollar loses this role, it appears to be the case the Fed can keep everything going just by providing the liquidity, because the liquidity goes into financial assets, into the stock market. So what it means is that the polarization will get worse in the United States. We already have a situation where relatively few people get all of the gain in income and all of the gain in wealth, because they're the ones that hold the shares. And so if the Fed keeps this going, then that is kept going is too. So that's kept going also. So the polarization worsens, the inequality in the distribution of income and wealth worsens. There's less of a domestic consumer market. There's less basis for the high stock prices, because there's no way for aggregate consumer demand to grow. And yet, if the money's going into financial assets, what's going to make the price go down? So this has been going on for a decade. I never thought this would happen. I didn't think that when this started a decade ago, I thought, oh, well, they're going to cause hyperinflation. But it didn't go into consumer prices. It went into financial asset prices. So, I mean, some of it went into consumer prices, yes, but not anything like what boosted share prices. So we've already been through the fact that where is a source of strong aggregate demand? It's not in business investment. They invest in buying the shares, not plant and equipment. The consumers don't have any real increase in real purchasing power. The young can't even form households. So where is the dynamic economy? It's just not there. So they create the impression by the way they measure things. And as long as stock prices are higher, the the elite are happy. The financial press is happy. Wall Street's happy. There's no complaint. The ordinary people don't have a voice. They're not important. They're not significant. They don't really understand what's going on. And so if you look at it, you know, in this way, which I think there's a good reason to look at it this way, it can go on until the dollar tanks. And what tanks the dollar, once again, is people say, look, it's too dangerous to use it. If we use the American systems and currency, we get hit with sanctions. So we're going to form our own SWIFT clearing system. We're going to form some way to settle our international transactions in our own currencies. We're going to bypass the dollar. In the past, when countries have tried to do this, like Gaddafi in Libya, we simply invade and kill him. China and Russia are a little bit too big for that. It's what we want to do to Iran. Iran says, you know, if we're going to abandon use of the dollar, well, that is what is a threat to us. Not tariffs. The threat is countries abandoning the use of the dollar. The demand for dollars shrinks. People don't want the dollars. You can't pay your bills by printing them. And we have big bills. You know, we run big trade deficits, big budget deficits. And those are financed by the willingness of the rest of the world to hold U.S. Treasury bonds. Well, that's the link right there, and that's the only point of vulnerability as far as I can tell. And if you try to think, how is all the quantitative easing going to get into consumer prices? Well, how does it get into the hands of people? A long time ago, in the Fed ease, it meant the banks could lend more money, and so people could acquire more debt and spend it, and this would help drive the economy. But, you know, they're so indebted now, and nobody, they can't service any more debt, and nobody will lend to them anyhow. So when you look at it, you know, realistically, you can say the thing is a Ponzi scheme, but its only weakness is, how long will people and the rest of the world continue to hold dollars? Well, what do we know? We know the Russians and the Chinese are selling off treasury bonds and buying gold. The Russians have just about got rid of their dollar holdings. We threaten everybody with sanctions, even our allies like Germany. If you buy Russian natural gas, we're going to sanction you. So the sanctions drive people away from the dollar. So this is foolishness. I mean, Washington is doing things that is destroying the basis of their power, the willingness to hold dollars. Well, how long will it take for them to destroy the dollar with their own foolish policies such as sanctions? I don't know. I can't say. It depends on how quick the rest of the world reacts. These are not things anybody can know, but I think I've given an explanation of what the real situation might be, and it's quite different from what you hear politically and read in the financial press and hear from economics departments. As far as I can tell, the American economics profession hasn't a clue.
You know, you're not parroting the don't worry, be happy crowd. And do you see any other storm clouds on the horizon?
Well, first of all, people have to have some means. So many things have been violated. For example, you know, you have many countries, I don't know if we've joined them or not, that now your bank deposits aren't really yours, they're the bank's. You remember what happened in Cyprus when the bank just announced that, well, you can't have your deposits?
They lost virtually everything. I think they got half if they moved quickly.
I mean, we always did in terms of the FDIC. They would you were insured up to a certain amount. But this is something, this is a new development, that if the bank's in trouble, instead of being bailed out, it just seizes its depositors' deposits. There's a name for that. I forget what they call it. I think we've legislated that as well. Not just European countries and so on. And the Canadians may have it. So the public anger at the bailout of the banks 10 years ago resulted in some kind of law that in the future there's not to be a bailout, there's to be a bail-in. They just survive by seizing the deposits. So, you know, what's your money? You don't even know that anymore. Suppose you acquire gold somewhere. What's to stop them from seizing your holdings? What's to stop them from passing a law like the Roosevelt did that you can't hold gold, turn it in at the price that we decide? You know, what? There's some evidence they're trying to get rid of cash so that you don't even have that option. They want to force you into paying with a card. And that way they can turn off your ability to buy whenever they want. So, you know, I just don't know that there are any answers. I don't know, you know, in the past, foreign governments collapse under American pressure. We forced the big French bank to pay billions of dollars in fines because they financed some business with Iran. Well, what the hell business is it of the United States to tell France, a French bank, who they can do business with? But we do. And they did business with Iran and violated our unilateral, arbitrary, illegal sanctions, and so we told them, okay, close down all your business in the U.S. or pay us $6 billion. Chris, just think about it. Germany asked us to give back the gold that they were storing here. We said no. Or we said, we'll give you a little bit now and maybe some more in the future. Venezuela asked the Bank of England to return the gold that they had on deposit there, and they said no. So when governments can't enforce contracts they have with other governments, other central banks, to return their own property, how can an individual expect that he's going to somehow find a safe haven? Or we, you know, Washington, we stole billions of dollars in Venezuelan deposits in our banks. I mean, I think the Venezuelan government was crazy to have any deposits in our banks, but they trusted the banking system, international law, and their country too, and they're a member of the United Nations. But okay, no, we don't like what you did. You nationalized your oil and are using it for your people instead of for the profits of ExxonMobil. So it's stealing all your bank deposits. So, you know, this type of behavior, how are you going to have a safe haven? Just a little individually. Wherever you look, you see this type of thing. I mean, look, we arrested, don't you remember, it wasn't that long ago, we arrested a high official, or the daughter of a high official of the Japanese technology firm. She's in Canada. It's a puppet state. It takes its orders from Washington. It's not an independent country. We said, go arrest that woman and hold her We're mad at this technology company because it's getting ahead of us in certain markets. Well, this is gangsterism. So when the United States government itself becomes the lead gangster, where is their safe haven?
Do you then expect this to implode? What would be the first shot across the bow that we should be watching for?
It's like I say, it's already started. There's already de-dollarization. There are already agreements made to not use the dollar to settle transactions. I mean, the Russians and the Chinese have started that. This Silk Road thing will draw more into that. Southeast Asia. It's just it seems to take longer than you think. I have no idea why in the world Russia and China didn't put an alternative SWIFT system up years ago. We keep hearing about it, they're talking about it, they're developing it, but it doesn't take any time to do that. Maybe they just don't want to pay the cost. Maybe they just want to use what we've already paid for. And so they're willing to take cost and sanctions not to have to put the thing into effect. I don't know. I don't know why they haven't. But it leaves them subject to these harassments and sanctions and seizure of assets, now seizure of people. So it's already started. The question is, when does it reach the straw that breaks the camel's back? You know, is this just a gradual thing, adding a straw every week, take forever, or is it going to be a pell-mell thing? Is it going to reach a point where there's just a run for the exits? I don't know. I don't know. And then if you look at the disunity in the United States, I mean, this identity politics we have, which teaches hatred. You know, the population split. Everybody's calling somebody else a name. There's no unity. If you have no unity of people, you can't hold the government accountable. They hate Trump so bad. They've created a make-believe world that he's in a conspiracy with Putin, and they have to impeach him. And there's no evidence whatsoever, but they all believe it. So facts don't matter. If facts don't matter, the truth doesn't matter. They frame up journalists. Julian Assange is framed up on some sort of crazy charges that make no sense. And he didn't publish anything any different than the New York Times published or the Guardian. But they're trying to shut people up, to stop people from telling the truth, because the truth gets in the way of their agendas. So they want to control the explanations. And they've done a good job of controlling the explanation of the economy. Everybody thinks, oh, we've had a boom for 10 years. Why didn't I get to participate in it? Oh, it's just me, some failure on my part, but everybody else did. So, I mean, you know, it's, you can tell people the absolute total truth. They can't tell the difference between the truth and fiction. It's more amenable to hear the fiction.
You know, it may not be the best news. Big dose of Veritas is just what we all... You know, that's where we find the solutions that even you are struggling, I think, to, well, all of us are struggling to identify here.
But, of course, truth, there's no respect for truth. It's discounted. Now it's all emote, emotion.
You found a venue here that appreciates your truth, and we can't thank you enough, and look forward to further comments from you, Dr. Roberts, and direct everybody over to your must bookmark webpage. Thank you.
Okay, Chris, appreciate your interest. I look forward to the link.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver medals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals, distributed ledger, and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on Atmex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Shopping for fine jewelry just got easier. GoldSeek.com has identified the most successful jewelry brand to launch in recent times. Many Jewelry is rewriting the way consumers buy fine jewelry. Integrity Craftsmanship, the only company to sell 24-karat gold and platinum jewelry, avoiding confusing alloys and gems, a true precious metals investment. Many Jewelry's disruptive business model embraces Franco-American craftsmanship and direct-to-consumer economics, rapidly disrupting the $20 billion monopoly, just like Amazon and Uber. The sky is the limit with $1 billion of jewelry purchases daily for loved ones and those special occasions. Many Jewelry is an innovator positioned to capture market share, with annual sales growth in the industry topping $30 billion by 2021. Many Jewelry coined the term investment jewelry, pricing by the gram, transparently disclosing its profit margins, a truer investment in pure gold or platinum. Similar to real estate, even artwork, Many Jewelry has a weighted value easily calculated, ensuring value wealth as a long-term investment. With sales in 60 countries around the globe, 20,000 orders already, don't miss out on the explosive growth potential. Many Jewelry trades under the symbols MENE on the Toronto Exchange and in the US, MENEF. Remember to sign up to Many's Shareholder Club to receive shareholder news, updates, and special discount codes for jewelry purchases. Remember, Many Jewelry.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.